loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, major media outlets lined up today to praise the tenure of Nikki Haley as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. The Washington Post said she succeeded in promoting multilateralism for a president who opposes multilateralism. The New York Times said Haley, quote, would be missed, unquote, and lauded her pragmatism and positive relationships with other diplomats. An Israeli diplomat lamented that, quote, now Israel has only one ambassador to the United Nations. Next, Turkish authorities investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi said today that the well-known writer appears to have entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, where he was killed on the orders of the Saudi leadership and dismembered by four men who subsequently left from the back of the building, drove to the airport, and flew to Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, condemnation of Khashoggi's apparent murder is rippling across the globe. Then, Israeli authorities have detained an American graduate student at the airport in Tel Aviv for the past week solely because she is a supporter of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. Laura Al-Qassam, whose grandparents are Palestinian, has a valid Israeli visa, but she will be deported because of her political views. She's being confined while she appeals the decision. And then, nearly 2 years ago, Marcus Mitchell and many other indigenous activists stood up to the oil and gas corporations trying to build the Dakota Access Pipeline through their land. While protesting to protect his land, Marcus was blinded in one eye and lost partial hearing in one ear due to a lead pellet shot directly at his head by a county sheriff. Yet now he's facing 2 years in prison. And finally, Google announced that it would drop out of a bid for a $10 billion cloud contract with the Defense Department, saying that the project conflicted with its corporate values. In the meantime, the company announced that it would create a search engine for use only in China that would make it impossible to use certain search terms. And the company is appealing a 5 billion euro fine for running a monopoly in Europe. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the resignation of the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. Major media outlets lined up today to praise Haley's tenure at the United Nations. The Washington Post said that she succeeded in promoting multilateralism for a president who opposes multilateralism. The New York Times said Haley would be missed and lauded her pragmatism and positive relationships with other diplomats. An Israeli diplomat lamented that, quote, now Israel has only one ambassador at the United Nations, unquote. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at rall.com, R-A-L-L.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted, I gotta say, in all seriousness, I think there might be two people named Nikki Haley at the United Nations, because the one that I followed just doesn't look anything like what the Washington Post and the New York Times are saying. What do you make of this?
That's because you're a thinking human being.
Well, I mean, even within their own praise, the New York Times acknowledges some of the really nasty things that Nikki Haley did at the UN. I mean, she was defended Trump every step of the way. She pushed his America First agenda against internationalism. She reduced aid to the Palestinians, who of course are suffering atrociously, especially in Gaza, where there's a serious human rights crisis going on. She's also helped creeping and spreading nuclearization. So, I mean, even, and they acknowledge those things in their own piece. And then they go on to basically say, in so many words, yeah, but it sort of comes down to, in the New York Times piece, at least, to, well, at least you didn't have an itchy Twitter finger. So that's how low the bar is. That's where we are. And it's it's kind of strange. I mean, she seems to be the latest beneficiary of this liberal slash democratic desire to have pet Republicans that, like, we really like this one.
Yes, you're absolutely right. We're seeing the same thing right now with Susan Collins.
I think we need to just, I don't know, I want to stop using the word liberal, because if the New York Times is liberal, the Washington Post is liberal, and they're supporting Nikki Haley, and they think we're going to miss her.
She's somehow bipartisan.
A bipartisan imperialist. And pretending that all the other diplomats at the UN loved Nikki Haley because she was such a collegial, multilateral figure. She was an imperial bully. I want to read, John, you will remember this because we talked about this. This is from the CNN, I don't know, way back when it was December 20th, 2017. Here's Nikki Haley speaking to her colleagues because she's a collectivist.
Right.
It was the Nikki Haley Commune, also known as the General Assembly. Quote, at the UN, we're constantly asked to do more and give more. In the past, we have, we meaning the United States. So when we make a decision at the will of the American people about where to locate our embassy, we don't expect those we've helped to target us. This means unilaterally, illegally recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This is what Haley wrote on Facebook. On Thursday, there will be a vote at the UN criticizing our choice, moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And yes, the U.S. will be taking names. Okay, so she's pointing her finger, in essence, at all of her colleagues and saying, if you don't vote with us, we're going to punish you, and I'm taking your name. Ted Rall, I mean, they can't be missing her that much.
Yeah, I think the only people who are going to be missing her are certain Democrats who on the editorial boards of major American newspapers with close ties to the White House and to, well, maybe more accurately, in the New York Times case, to the CIA. It is a ridiculous thing. And, you know, this is really an unrequited phenomenon, right? I mean, Republicans don't spend any time saying, hey, here's the pet Democrats that we like. But Democrats love this sort of thing. And what's really peculiar about it is—
Good point.
It's not even, you know, in the Brett Kavanaugh matter, for example, really, Susan Collins still hasn't really been lambasted, but Lisa Murkowski is supposed to be the Republican we like. But how come? But we don't say that, right? So it's the whole thing is peculiar. John McCain, who was we talked about, was so far to the right it was crazy on both domestic and on foreign affairs. But somehow, I'm not even sure where. I mean, it's not in his voting record. He was a moderate. He was reasonable. He was a maverick. I mean, if a maverick votes consistently with his own party, how is he a maverick?
I want to just talk to people who are part of the anti-Trump so-called resistance, because the New York Times, they published that op-ed from the inside person inside the administration who said they're waging guerrilla war to stop Donald Trump from acting on his worst impulses. They told us that they were going to be, you know, remembered as great heroes. The New York Times published their anonymous account. The New York Times has been ranting against Donald Trump, as we do, of course, too. But they've been, you know, there's a difference between this, our position, which is progressive and grassroots, and the New York Times, which is the big, you know, ruling class elite so-called resistance. Here you have Nikki Haley, and they love her. So if you're part of the anti-Trump resistance, remember, if you're following the New York Times or the Washington Post, they want the next group of leaders in the country to be like Nikki Haley. And the thing that they think Nikki Haley is better than Trump, the reason they distinguish Nikki Haley from Trump, is that Trump said, at least, maybe we should have good relations with Russia. I mean, he's gotten over that.
Right.
But Nikki Haley, during that entire period, has been vehement in ramping up and ratcheting up the anti-Russia rhetoric. So what the resistance really wants is more war. It's like, be against Trump because he's not warlike enough, which is amazing.
See, that's the thing that they can all agree on.
Yeah.
That's the bipartisanship, yeah, right there.
Because it says so much about who the liberal, again, a word that no longer has meaning, what the liberal resistance is to Trump. Go ahead, Ted Rall.
Well, I'm going to make a case here that we should probably keep the word liberal, but the word, you know, language changes, and the word liberal has changed, and I think now it's liberal in the sense of the economic meaning of the term, rather than the political ideology. So it's capitalist liberalism, neoliberalist liberalism, making the world free for a transnational corporate market opening, rather than the traditional sort of Hubert Humphrey, Franklin Delano Roosevelt approach to liberalism that many of us grew up with. But that seems to be dead. I mean, you know, there hasn't been a major liberal program passed by a Democratic president since the Lyndon Johnson administration. There hasn't been a major poverty program, anti-poverty program, since the 1960s. Liberalism is no more, but this is what liberalism is now.
Yeah, okay. I go with you on that. When you look at Bill Clinton or George W. Bush, not only are they all friends with each other, they were friends with Donald Trump too, by the way.
But yeah, in fact, the Clintons went to Donald Trump's wedding. To Melania.
Of course they did. They're all pals. They all hung out in New York City together. They're part of the same elite circles. But Ted Rall is right. What the last 30 years has been neoliberal capitalist economic policies, which means drain the country of its factories, send those factories overseas, because guess what? You can exploit workers at a greater level, you can pay them less, the corporate profiteers can make even more. And then these Democrats can posture as if they're the great friends of the people. And eventually, the traditional Democratic working class base of the Democratic Party has turned against it, at least in some parts of the country. And they all say, oh, it's because they're a basket of deplorables, et cetera, et cetera. When in fact, the deplorables are the people at the top in both parties. And of course, Nikki Haley is first and foremost amongst them. What happens next, Ted Rall? Because you are a brilliant prognosticator about all things political, what happens to Nikki Haley next?
Oh, well, she says she's not running for president, and she says it in a way that actually I'm inclined to believe. I bet she's not running for president in 2020 unless something happens to Trump and he dies or gets impeached or whatever. who knows? But I think she's running for president in 2024. She's a little on the young side. She's a little too. She needs some time to gin up support. And as a woman of color, she's not really a member of the right party to run for president yet. So that's going to require some, she's going to have quite a campaign war chest. Republicans, a lot of forward-looking Republicans are very enthusiastic about her. They really think she's the great female hope for the GOP. So I would think that she would be preparing to run. I would guess that she's probably going to go to either some sort of academia career in the interim. People forget that Ike was president of Columbia University between the time that he was the supreme commander of Allied forces during World War II, and then he first ran for president in 1952. I could see him, Ken Starr went off to be president at Pepperdine University. I could see her landing someplace like that, some small college president kind of thing for a few years. Or I could also, she might, end up at, I don't see her at Fox somehow.
No.
I think that's like, that will take away, it'll tarnish her brand.
Yeah, because the Washington Post and the New York Times are supporting her right now. She'd be perfect.
Well, Donald Trump said this morning that she's going to get rich in the next few years.
Yeah. Final words on this. The fact, I mean, who gets to resign in the Oval Office?
Yeah,
I mean,
nobody.
It was such an obviously orchestrated event to help Nikki Haley in whatever's coming next.
We were joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Go to Rall.com and you can check out his work. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Turkish authorities investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi said today that the well-known journalist appears to have entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, where he was killed on the orders of the Saudi leadership and dismembered by four men who subsequently left the back of the building, drove to the airport, and flew to Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, condemnation of Khashoggi's apparent murder is rippling across the globe. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, and we recorded this segment at 11:30 a.m. today. Ali, welcome back.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Ali, this is a gruesome story, and the Turks have been very forthcoming with the evidence that they're developing in Turkey. At the same time, leaders from around the world are condemning any idea that Jamal Khashoggi was executed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. I know that you have to leave because you're going to a demonstration at the Saudi embassy in Washington. Tell us what you're hearing and tell us what you hope to accomplish at the demonstration today.
Well, we just want to bring attention not only to Jamal Khashoggi, but to other dissidents. Jamal was not really a dissident in the classic sense. You know, he was a loyalist. He had allegiance, like he said, to the king. He was critical of the Saudi crown prince, the mad king of Saudi Arabia. And the fact that he was a loyalist and he still remains, in contact with maybe members of the ruling family abroad, especially, and maybe doing his writing and to support their struggle against MBS, that was a greater crime just from being a dissident, a classic dissident, because the Saudi leadership, especially MBS, is sending a message to his followers that they should not cross the line and desert. So they are fearing desertion and defection within their ranks. And that is maybe the greatest threat to the regime's survivability is if they have their own structure collapse. People have been against the regime for many years, like myself. I'm the oldest active dissident in the United States. And I've realized these dangers, and I would avoid what Jamal Khashoggi has done. He made that mistake for one reason or another, but let's hope he's alive. Maybe some people are saying he's alive, because killing him is very hard in that environment, because it's going to be clear to people that's what happened.
Let me ask you about MBS. Of course, we're talking about Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who appears to be running the country while his father is nominally the king. If this is true, if Khashoggi was executed inside this consulate, this raises Mohammed bin Salman's behavior to a whole new level. Already, we've seen this aggression in Yemen. We've seen the threats against the government of Qatar. But executing a well-known journalist who, as you point out rightly, is not really an oppositionist.
No, he's a loyalist.
He's a loyalist.
Who has criticisms.
Right, who has criticisms. This really takes the Saudi government to a new level. Is this something that we should expect to see more of? And does this in any way weaken the Saudi government, threaten the Saudi government?
We should expect this, because this is not the first time Mohammed bin Salman has used violence and harsh measures against others who disagree with him. People read a story about him putting his mother in, under house arrest, his younger brothers under house arrest, of course, his cousins, his competitors, he removed them from power and put them under house arrest. That's understandable. But I wrote a story back in April about him beating his own wife, carrying domestic violence against his own wife to the degree that she was hospitalized. So this type of personality is a violent personality, and he does not care. The fact that he put the elected head of the Lebanese government, Saad al-Hariri, and held him against his will and forced him to resign, and he didn't get flack for doing that. This is an international crime.
That's true.
That encouraged him. Forget the Yemen war and the starvation. The Mohammed bin Salman, according to my numbers, and the international community that you speak of, the United Nations is covering up for him. The number one king of children in the world is Mohammed bin Salman. The number of children who have died because of the Saudi war and siege and starvation of the Yemeni people is in over 100,000 so far. But the United Nations and the Western powers have covered it up. He's got away with that. So this is really a chump change. It's small to kill or kidnap one journalist. I am, however, surprised. Maybe a little bit curious, maybe suspicious of this reaction. The United States government who are supporting actively the Saudi war and Yemen of starvation and disease and bombardment, suddenly are concerned about one guy being kidnapped or killed, killing children. I mean, look at the statement of the State Department about the 40 children who have been killed in Saudi bombing in the bus. It was very supportive of the Saudi monarchy. Here, we see a different tone. Note what Mr. Trump, President Trump, was saying over the past 2 weeks. He continuously, including last night for the fourth time, say that the Saudi king must pay, the Saudi king must pay. They will not survive for 2 weeks. And so that leads me to believe that there is something behind the scene, that there is something that the U.S. wants from Mohammed bin Salman, and Mohammed bin Salman either dragging his feet or declining to deliver. Is it some project, arms sales, some policy, or something else? I have no idea. He might be thinking of restoring a relationship with the Iranians, because that would be much cheaper for him than giving hundreds of billions of dollars to the American coffers. I don't know, honestly. But the reality is, this is very, it has never happened before. It's unprecedented, this reaction in the media and from Congress and the administration to this case, which is deserving, obviously. You know, no one should doubt that killing or kidnapping even a loyalist person is wrong in this way, especially. But this is very suspicious to me. He may try now, he's a megalomaniac, he's trying to grow his own wings, and the American administration will not have that. They don't want independent government.
We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, you know, John, I remember Ali when Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, came to the United States. He was welcomed by Trump, but he was also welcomed by liberals and conservatives alike.
Across
Harvard,
the country.
MIT, Disney World.
Oprah Winfrey.
Everybody rolled out the red carpet for this guy. And they were all talking about him as a big reformer. And Ali was on our show. And Ali, you know, prophetically said, no, he's not.
This is
what the Saudis always do. There won't be reforms. And if the reforms happen, they're cosmetic reforms, completely cosmetic. Ali, you're suggesting, though, just we only have about 2.5 minutes left, maybe killing him would be too much, that maybe instead they've kidnapped him. Do you think if that's the case, we'll hear about it, or will he just vanish into the netherworld?
The famous case of Nasser Saeed, a longtime activist and writer in 1979, he inspires us, because he's the person that most of the country, he's actually the only national figure in the country, meaning that non-governmental. And he was kidnapped from Beirut in 1979 and lured using basically an interview, a media interview, and he was kidnapped by Palestinian gunmen, given to the Saudis and taken to Saudi Arabia, never heard from again. He was killed. And the ironic thing is, the person in charge of that operation is Turki Faysal, who was the head of intelligence at the time. And Turkey and Jamal Khashoggi worked for Turki Faysal since the 1980s with the Afghanistan campaign, with the so-called jihad and mujahideen and so on. And until recently in London in 2005, and in Washington as an advisor, a close advisor, and worked for his brother too. So this is the ironic thing. It's he will work for the man who did something, and now he's facing the same fate. I think we will know shortly if he's alive. If he's alive, we will know within the next week. But if he's dead, and he was dismembered like this, some people are saying, I don't think the Saudis will let that known, unless the Turkish government, which has been very smart about this, would give evidence to the fact.
That was the voice of Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs here in Washington. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll stay on this story. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israeli authorities have detained an American graduate student at the airport in Tel Aviv for the past week solely because she's a supporter of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, program. Laura Al-Qassem, whose grandparents are Palestinian, has a valid Israeli visa, but she will be deported just because of her political views. She's being confined while she appeals the decision. We're joined from Florida by Reem Zeitoun. She is the president of Students for Justice in Palestine at Florida State University. Reem, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Reem, this is controversial, even by Israeli standards. This grad student has a valid visa, which she applied for and was granted by the Israeli embassy in Washington. She didn't provoke any sort of a disturbance on the flight or at the airport. This is happening just because of her political views. Should we expect to see more of this? And is there anything that Palestinian Americans or even non-Palestinian Americans who support BDS and want to go to Israel can do to help themselves?
So regarding your first point, yes, we will continue to see more of this. Palestinian organizers, activists, even non-Palestinians who support the plight of the Palestinian struggle, we are constantly in every facet, in every sector of society, berated, just silenced and erased by Zionist propaganda and Zionist strategies to silence the Palestinian voice. So yes, we will continue to see this just because the Zionist entity itself knows it cannot exist. It is a colonizer's platform on which the Zionist entity can exist. And so long as it creates this pushback against students and organizers, there will be no peace. There will be no silence on anyone's end. So yes, we do expect this to continue happening, but in terms of pushback, that will also continue to happen as well. In regards to anything that people can do, yes. So we need more mobilization regarding this. We need more education. And above all, we need higher numbers. We need more and more people to understand just how severe the situation is and just how much Israel works and how hard they're working to silence Palestinian voice, organizing and linking up with organizations across the world and nationwide is the greatest strategy that we can use to combat this.
Reem, I want to read to you a quote from the Strategic Affairs Minister Erdan. This person spearheads the Israeli government's efforts against the boycott movement, and he's explaining why Lara is not going to be allowed into Israel, why she will instead be deported. Quote, Lara served as president of a chapter of one of the most extreme and hate-filled anti-Israeli BDS groups in the U.S. Israel will not allow entry to those who work to harm the country, whatever their excuse. Now, again, people are listening to our show here in Washington, D.C. Maybe they just turned it on. They don't actually perhaps know what this all is about. So let's help people understand. The Israeli government is denying her entree because of her political views and her activism with BDS, which they call an extreme and hate-filled organization. What is BDS?
BDS is nothing more than a political tool to weaken the oppressor. There is nothing that BDS has ever outlined in its entire standing that delineates any hate, any harm, any physical violence or assault to the Zionist entity. We work within BDS to weaken Zionist companies, to boycott from them, to not pay physical actual money for their products. We work to divest so that we take money out of investments, out of different companies that work with Zionist entities, and we work to educate surrounding that. So this language that's being used against BDS organizers and against the BDS movement in general is, in a word, just inaccurate. It's wrong, and it's just, it doesn't apply. It's inapplicable. We are not a hateful organization. It's a matter of economics. It's a matter of weakening the Zionist state from the inside out. So if we're going to ban students for identifying with the BDS movement, it's preposterous. It makes no sense. Like, what are we actually supposed to be pushing against that? It's completely an economic movement to weaken the Zionist entity. Yeah, there's no idea surrounding it that would allude to hate whatsoever.
John, what people may not understand is that boycott, divest, and sanctions of the State of Israel is like the boycott against the apartheid government in
Absolutely
South Africa.
Correct. Absolutely right.
And what the boycott, divest, sanctions movement says is that Israel has functioned as a colonial project, has illegally occupied the lands of the indigenous Palestinian peoples there, both in historic Palestine, what is now called the State of Israel proper, but also in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in other territories. So people are urging people don't buy products because it's an apartheid state, similar to what the state of South Africa was. And that international peaceful boycott, divest, sanctions movement against South Africa became critically important to the ending of apartheid in South Africa. Critically important. And I think the Israeli government is now treating BDS, which is this peaceful movement along the lines of the anti-apartheid movement, as a criminal mm-hmm. or almost terrorist enterprise, simply because the peaceful character of it is in fact a threat, because millions of people want, tens of millions, hundreds of millions want justice for Palestinians.
And this is exactly what Martin Luther King warned people about in the mid-1960s. Don't forget, too, that one of the reasons why I think the Israelis are so afraid is because they know, just like everybody else in the world knows, that the boycott and divestment movement against South Africa in the 1980s worked, and it brought down that apartheid government. Because the BDS movement is nonviolent, that's the threat. It would be so much easier for the Israelis if supporters of BDS were violent or took up arms, because then they would have a far easier propaganda victory. But because this is a peaceful movement, it's an economic movement, it makes it that much more difficult to confront. And all the Israelis can do at this point is to snatch individual students at the airport and throw them out of the country.
Reem, let me ask you just a follow-up to John's point. You know, the Israeli government conflates Zionism, the ideology of Zionism, and the Israeli state with the Jewish people. But in fact, we can see all over the United States, there are large numbers of Jewish Americans who, especially younger people, who are standing with the BDS movement. Is that what you're seeing on campus as well, or on campuses around the country?
I mean, yes, absolutely. Something we need to make very clear is that Zionism is not Judaism, and that is one of the greatest successes that Zionism has perpetrated against the Palestinian struggle, is that Judaism somehow coincides with Zionism. That is never and has never and will never be true. I have multiple Jewish organizers who are my comrades who stand up and organize for the Palestinian struggle endlessly. And that goes for millions of Jews across the world. So conflating, yes, the Israeli state has been very successful with conflating Zionism with Judaism and linking the two together to make a stronger case for their colonial project. It does build it up, and it does gain greater support for it, because something that we do on the outside, non-Jews, is we wrongly, a lot of the times, conflate a lot of Jews with being Zionists, which is a false conflation, and that's something we need to stop doing. So, yes, on our campuses, yes, we do see a lot of Zionist presence. Yes, we see a lot of anti-BDS, anti-Palestinian sentiment. But does that mean we don't have the counter? No, yes, we do. There's always a lot of Jewish comrades who organize with the Palestinian people, who always are organized with the Palestinian struggle and 100% stand behind the BDS movement.
Reem, it seems to me, just looking at this from a political perspective, that this is going to backfire on the Israelis. We've got 30 seconds left. Give us your thoughts on that.
It is 100% already backfiring on the Zionist entity. We are in real time watching the Zionist state crumbling in front of us. All this pushback that they're creating against BDS students who organize for BDS, it's weakening their case, and they know it, and that's why they're scrambling to extend her court date. They're paying for lawyers, et cetera. They're weakening in real time, and we're watching it happen.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Florida by Reem Zeitoun. She's the president of Students for Justice in Palestine at Florida State University. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Nearly 2 years ago, Marcus Mitchell and many other indigenous activists stood up to the oil and gas corporations trying to build the Dakota Access Pipeline through their land. While protesting to protect his land, Marcus was blinded in one eye and lost partial hearing in one ear due to a lead pellet shot directly at his head by a county sheriff. Yet it's he who is now facing years in prison. We're joined from Montana by Candy Mossett. Candy is the Indigenous Environmental Network's Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer. Candy took part in the Standing Rock protests of 2017. Candy Mossett, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for having me on today.
I saw the Guardian article, Guardian newspaper, it's from the UK, about Marcus Mitchell. There's a picture of him. He's clearly, his face has been badly damaged. He was shot right into the eye. The article is so, I mean, it's so riveting. Standing Rock activist faces prison after officer shot him in the face. And it's such a graphic thing. I want to read a couple of sentences to you from the article and then we'll begin. Marcus Mitchell lay face down on the snowy North Dakota prairie, blood pouring through the gaping wound on the left side of his face. It was just past midnight on 19 January 2017, and a Morton County Sheriff's deputy had just shot the 21-year-old indigenous activist with a beanbag pellet amid a demonstration near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The lead pellet entered Mitchell's left eye socket, shattering the orbital wall of his eye and his cheekbone, and ripping open a flap of skin nearly to his left ear. And then, Candy, this article, which I really encourage people to read, goes on to talk about he's the victim now of a law enforcement prosecution, even though he was the victim of this law enforcement gratuitous assault. Let's talk about the case.
So I know Marcus, really great person, great human being, just a young kid, really, and just down for the cause, you know, went out there, quit school, went out there to help, to protect water. It was one of those things where there was so much mass chaos and confusion going on. So many people were getting hurt, but of the several people that were getting hurt, they were getting shot either in the face or in the groin. There were like 500 people that went to like our medics at camp had the same injuries. They were just using us for target practice. And Marcus got hit with the beanbag in his eye and people didn't even know where he was. Like they just took him, didn't tell anybody where he was, had him locked up at the hospital, like strapped to his bed, wouldn't allow him to even use a phone or anything. It was really sick the way that he was treated after having been shot by the police, who continually said that they weren't doing anything wrong out there. And he was one of several people. And he just continues on. He was at the Protecting Mother Earth gathering that we had this past summer in June out in the Nisqually territory. And he was just so amazing. You know, he got up on stage and was talking about the Just Transition work that they're doing with Black Mesa Water Coalition. And it was amazing because I'm for IEN right now, the Indigenous Environmental Working Network, I'm working on the Just Transition and Extreme Energy program. And he was just right out there talking about the good things that are happening, talking about how great things are going on in Diné lands and territories. Even after all this happened to him, 21 years old, blind in his eye, can't hear, has all of these nerve damage and problems from what they did to him. And here he's still wants to help in other fights and struggles. He still wants to help fight against the Bayou Bridge pipeline in Louisiana, which is actually the tail end of the Dakota Access Pipeline in Louisiana, where friends are going through the same kind of treatment from police and private security firms. People don't know about it as much as Dakota Access, but it continues to happen in this country.
Yeah, we don't hear much about that at all. I'd love to be able to do a story about that and expose that. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking with Candy Mossett. She is the Indigenous Environmental Network's Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer. We're talking about the case of Marcus Mitchell, 21-year-old man who was shot in the face by a deputy sheriff, then shackled, Candy is telling us, to his bed. Nobody knew where he was, Candy, right? He was kind of lost, and the Guardian article goes over that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's literally how it played out. People were really worried. It was almost like they just, you know, took him. And I think the article even says kidnapped him. And there's if you go on Facebook, you know, there are more graphic pictures that are actually being edited out because he showed what his face looked like that day. And you actually have to uncover the photo on Facebook to be able to see what he looked like when this happened to him. And for them to be treating him like a common criminal in that state is pretty sickening. And to have a person outside of his door, like a private security person, as if he was going to go anywhere, is really sickening. It's a testament to the corruption of the whole Standing Rock movement, the whole DAPL movement, but also just everything that's happening in this country underneath this number 45 administration.
So when you're talking about those pictures, those graphic pictures of what actually happened to him being censored, who's censoring them? Is it Facebook?
It's just on Facebook because it's considered so graphic that there's actually a warning and you have to click on another button to uncover the photo to be able to see it. It's not, you can see it. It's just that it gives you a warning because it's so graphic.
Okay. So Candy, there were many, many acts of violence against the protesters. And those acts of violence, in fact, gained a great deal of media attention because this peaceful assembly, these peaceful protesters didn't disperse. They stayed. They stayed through terrible weather. They were occupying the land. They made the point, we are not protesters. You made the point, we are not protesters. We are protectors. We are protecting the land. Our presence there prevented this sort of violation of the land that would, of course, not only be going into sacred indigenous lands and just sovereign indigenous lands, but also doing it in such a way that would likely damage the environment in the time to come. In September 2016, construction workers bulldozed a section of the land that the tribe there had identified as a sacred ground. And then protesters were viciously attacked with attack dogs. I saw pictures. I remember them. And I think I spoke with you about them at the time, where these attack dogs were just ripping at people's skin and people were bleeding. I mean, it was just the kind of most vicious attempt to make people go away. And yet you and the others didn't go away. You were just so steadfast. It was such an amazing demonstration by power and evil against people who were trying to protect land. Go ahead.
Well, here's the thing. You know, as Native Nations, I myself am Mandan Hidatsa Rikara from the North Dakota area. Look, it's been 500 years. Colonization has come. You know, Native people have survived through an era of termination when, you know, there was an quote unquote Indian problem in this country. And, you know, according to our current president, there still is. And they're trying to still get rid of us. It's just in a different context. All of the stuff that happened at Standing Rock is a prime example of what this foundation of this country was built upon, which is the taking and raping of the earth and pillaging of other people's lands. And we never went away. Standing Rock was yet another uprising. You might remember Wounded Knee in the 1970s and how people were treated there. I mean, people are still, and Leonard Peltier are still imprisoned 40-something years later as a result of events that occurred there. We have Red Fawn, who's imprisoned, who got 4 years, I believe, for being set up, basically, by an FBI informant, an FBI agent. She's serving jail time. You look at how when people say hokahe or something in the Lakota language, it means it's a good day to die. It literally is people on the front lines. And I know sometimes people are sensitive about using that word front lines as if it connotates war. But if people don't think that that's what's happening in this country, then they're very blindsided and they're very brainwashed by television and radio, because there is this continuation of this war that's happening where capitalism, this continued growth, take from the earth and never expecting any bad repercussions is happening. That's connected to the larger problem of the climate change that we find ourselves in. Now we have an administration that is now admitting, oh yes, we are in a crisis and we're probably going to increase our weather patterns by 7 degrees over the next, you know, by 2100, but we're not going to do anything about it. You know, and so it's really a fight and a struggle for our very survival, not only as Native nations, but just as humanity and all living beings on this planet. More and more people have to be willing to step up and fight back. That was just one pipeline. We're still fighting the Bakken, the fracking that's happening, where the oil's coming from to go through that pipeline. That is a symptom. And we're trying to get to the root causes. And it's people like Marcus that have that same vision, that are willing to go and to say, you know what? I may have gotten hurt once. I'm still going to go fight Bayou Bridge. Because who am I? I'm just one person in the grand scheme of things. If I can help save the planet, if I can help change something for maybe my future children one day, 200 years down the road, well, then that's what matters.
That's Candy Mossett. We're talking to Candy from Montana. She is the Indigenous Environmental Network's Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer. We're talking to her about the upcoming trial of Marcus Mitchell. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Google announced that it would drop out of a bid for a $10 billion cloud contract with the Defense Department, saying that the project conflicted with its corporate values. In the meantime, the company is appealing a 5 billion euro fine for running a monopoly in Europe. We're joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Dr. Epstein, welcome back.
It's always a pleasure.
Before we get to these other issues, I wanted to talk to you about Google Plus and leaks having to do with Google. And Google's taken it on the chin this past week. Google Plus was never a very popular social media platform, but the company was not forthcoming when it came to a hack. They never told their clients, their customers, that their information had been hacked. Nobody liked the thing anyway, and they just shut it down. So tell us what's happening at Google right now.
Okay, to put this in context, there are at least 6 platforms online that have more than 1 billion people on them. And for quite a while now, 5 of them have been controlled by Google. So we're all familiar with YouTube, Gmail, Chrome, Google Maps. I mean, you get the idea. So there's only been one platform, one mega platform that Google has not controlled. And that is a social network like Facebook. So that's the only one. So Google Plus was Google's second attempt to compete with Facebook and basically dominate that last market. And basically now they're admitting complete and total failure. So if you read their blog about them shutting down Google Plus, yes, it partly has to do with the fact that Google Plus was compromised, yes. It also has to do with the fact that they just never got any real traction on it. So they've actually given up. The bad part of that is that means now that the world has truly been divided up, if you see what I mean, because there's no more competition of any sort between Google and Facebook.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad Dr. Epstein put it that way, because the world being divided up, when you think about like what led to World War One, all the markets had been divided up by these handful of monopoly mm-hmm. colonizing competitors, and then they just had to fight it out for who was going to take whose spoils. But here you have a division of labor now, where Google controls almost everything with the exception of Facebook, Is it peaceful coexistence or will it be war?
I think we're talking about peaceful coexistence. I mean, Google and Microsoft signed a secret pact in early 2016, dropped all complaints, all lawsuits against each other, and did a lot of other things that we don't know about. So that's, again, an example of, you know, dividing up the universe. And, you know, this is another example. They've backed off in this one area. But Google, in the last few days, I mean, has been in the news for all kinds of things. It's not just that. But that is news that they've said, okay, we're giving up on, you know, that one market.
Let's talk about the $5 billion euro fine in Europe. Why did the EU fine Google, and what's the status of the fine?
Well, this was the second big fine. There have been three antitrust actions in progress against Google in Europe. First one concluded last year. Google was fined $2.7 billion, and that was for having biased search results, which, of course, is one thing that I've been studying for a long, long time. So they, you know, the EU concluded, yeah, they really do put their own products and services ahead of competitors, and they fine them substantially. Google paid the fine and appealed. The second big fine was just recently $5.1 billion. That was for monopolistic practices in the mobile computing market. In other words, that's Android. And so that's an even bigger fine. And now Google has appealed. But I believe, once again, they have paid the fine. I'm actually in the process of trying to confirm that. And that's not the end, because there's still a third antitrust action in progress, which is going to probably be concluded fairly soon. And my guess is will also result in another huge fine. And, you know, even with these appeals filed, if Google hasn't made certain changes by certain dates, then they're subject to daily penalties that are quite substantial. So it still is up in the air, but that's still a very good possibility too.
Yeah, this isn't finished yet.
$5 billion sounds like a lot of money to me. Is it a lot of money to Google?
Oh no. Their projected revenue this year is over $100 billion. And their profit margin is one of the highest of any company in the world. So this is cost of doing business to a company like Google. I mean, obviously a lot of other companies would be destroyed by fines this big, but for them, I think it's just cost of doing business.
There was another reason too this week that Google was in the news, and that is that they've finally come to an agreement with the Chinese government to create a search engine that blocks certain search terms. Terms like Nobel Peace Prize or student unrest. Isn't that exactly what Google said that they wouldn't do when their current kerfuffle with the Chinese began a few years ago?
That is correct. And Google has been asked, actually point blank, by Vice President Pence to stop this relationship, end this relationship with the Chinese. They've also been there have been protests among Google's employees about this relationship as well. But it looks like this indeed is going forward. Google now and then does back down on things. So they did back down on another thing, you know, this week. But it looks like they're going forward with the Chinese because, you know, it's 1.4 billion people. And it's the fastest growing economy in the world. And it's, you know, very tech oriented. So, you know, I get it. I mean, it's, you know, they're a business. They're out to make money.
There's one way of looking at this, which is that Google is violating its basic democratic principles. But on the other hand, Google is an American company, and the American companies are part of the American, you know, protected and shielded by the American government. And that American government, including Mike Pence, has basically made a declaration of war against China. So wouldn't China suspect that an American company that has this mass capacity to communicate with Chinese people try to undermine through its search rankings or whatever the legitimacy of the Chinese government? I mean, if you're the Chinese government, you're going to say, yeah, this is letting the enemy inside the gates. So we're going to make a deal with them. The deal is you get to make tons of money, but you have to censor the product such that it's not or minimizes the danger to us, we, the Chinese government. And these are our laws. And so the Google has to conform with the laws of any country, of any government, if it wants to do business there. That's the quid pro quo. Matter of fact, every American company that's doing business in China, the Chinese government lays down the rules of the road and they have to make a decision. Do we want this 1.4 billion person market, in which case we have to conform with Chinese regulations, or do we not? Then there's the other element of it. And I want to quote from because we're talking about China, which is under the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. I want to quote from Vladimir Lenin now and his famous speech, "The capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang them." A very famous quote, meaning that the avarice and greed of the different capitalists is such that they will, in fact, do anything to make a profit, including selling the rope with which their opponents might hang them. Anyway, we have about a minute left. Dr. Epstein, what else is really big about Google that we want to mention right now?
Well, there have been more leaks. The biggest leak just came last night. That is an internal briefing at Google, which is called The Good Censor. The Good Censor. And I've read the entire document, and it's actually it's a beautifully done analysis of the fact that, you know, there's supposed to be this open platform for free speech, but at the other hand, more and more they're being called upon to curate and edit, and they're trying to figure that out, and they're really struggling. But they're acknowledging, really, that they are now the biggest censor in the world. I've written about that in a piece called The New Censorship. So that's big news. And then there's a couple more seconds here. I can tell you that a Google employee recently tweeted an FU message. This is a guy named Dave Hoag. To the GOP, "You are all finished, GOP. You polish the final nail for your own coffins. F you all to hell." So that's straight from a Google a Google design lead.
But one of the Google executives was at Bart O'Kavanaugh swearing in for the Supreme Court. I guess they're playing all angles here.
Apparently.
They do play all angles.
Well, they are. They really are. And I think what's happening in China is personally is despicable. But some people are predicting, you know, that the internet is going to split. There is the great firewall of China already, but some people are splitting. There are going to be two separate internets within a few years. One that's Chinese, and it's all in Chinese, and it's, you know, controlled by China, and then the other one.
I think we need a third internet where people, like a really grassroots internet, which is free and unfettered, so that entities like Google and Facebook can't be telling us either in the United States or anywhere what to read or what not to read. Because, in fact, these monopoly corporations have, as you've pointed out, Dr. Epstein, without any other government interference, a tyrannical control over what we think, what we hear, what we see first. And it's an opinion molding.
There are people also working on this third alternative, which is creating a new kind of internet, which is free and open the way it was supposed to be. And one of the people working on that is Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web.
Huh. That is worth another segment. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.